From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a young woman was preparing for a big life change. She was studying for the bar exam and getting ready to move to New York City. And during this time, she started to vomit blood. Days later, at 27 years old, she was diagnosed with gastric cancer. She postponed her exam. She scheduled her treatment. Doctors removed part of her stomach. And as she told the Wall Street Journal in January, she's still coming to terms with what this diagnosis means for her diet, her dating life, her health, her future. "That's a fun icebreaker," she said. "I don't have a stomach anymore," she likes to tell people, end quote. Data shows the rate of young people diagnosed with cancer is on the rise. Doctors are scrambling to determine what is causing these diseases and how to identify who is most at risk. Some research suggests that it has to do with lifestyle factors, including physical activity. Sometimes there are questions about diet, processed foods, toxins, the environment, and more. Research also shows that survivors of childhood, adolescent, and young adult cancers are more likely than their peers to experience mental health challenges. As the local nonprofit 1330 says, adolescents and young adults with cancer have not always been recognized as a distinct demographic with unique challenges and treatment needs. Traditionally, AYAs, as they're called, were considered either pediatric or adult patients and were treated accordingly, despite not fitting well in either group. And this hour, we're talking about the state of adolescent and young adult cancers and how to support patients and survivors. And I'd like to welcome our guests. And speaking of, we have a cancer survivor with us. Michaela Deeg is a community engagement manager for 1330 Cancer Connect, a cancer survivor herself. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Caitlin McDougall is a licensed clinical social worker and program director for 1330 Cancer Connect. Caitlin, thank you for being here as well.
Very welcome.
Charlie Cote is with us. Charlie is a licensed clinical social worker in private practice, board president at 1330 Cancer Connect, and a bereaved father. Lost his son in 2005, is that right?
Yeah.
At age 18. Mm-hmm. Welcome back here. It's always lovely to see you. And I always, these conversations with you are always so painful, and yet it fills up our cup because of who you are. So thanks for being here, Charlie.
Thanks.
We appreciate that. And Dr. Jamie Fleur-Laghi is here, associate professor in the Cancer Center and the Departments of Pediatrics, Hematology, and Oncology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Doctor, thank you for making time for the program
today. I'm honored to be here.
Caitlin, tell people what 1330 Cancer Connect is, first of all, for those who don't know it.
Yeah. We're a local nonprofit here in Rochester. We also have a Syracuse center, and our mission is to support teens and young adults with cancer to live their best lives today.
Everybody sort of wishes you didn't need to exist.
Of course.
And yet you help a lot of people. And I know over the years we've heard these kind of stories. In fact, I think we're going to get a chance to talk to Lauren Spiker later this hour. And these stories are always so moving because often my guess is people find you only when they're hearing of you for the first time when they're in some of the worst days of their lives, probably. Is that fair?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. It's not something we often hear this. This is the club I didn't want to be a part of.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's we'll talk to Charlie coming up here, see how he's doing. And I want to start with Michaela's story as well, if you don't mind, because you're coming up on 13 years cancer free.
Yeah.
Congratulations there. How do you feel?
Good. I mean, I think I'm sort of in the next portion of my survivorship where now it's sort of these long-term effects. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize, especially with teens and adults. Treatment and your world with cancer doesn't end on that last day of treatment. You know, I'm years out, luckily, don't really have much of a concern anymore of my initial cancer coming back. But now I sort of face the realities of those treatments that I got that saved my life could now potentially lead to a secondary cancer.
You were a sophomore in high school when you were diagnosed?
Yeah.
Can you tell us the story?
Absolutely. So I was a sophomore in high school, and it actually started about the fall of my high school year. And I started getting this really intense itching on my legs, sort of similar to like a bug bite. You itch it for a little bit, a scab appears, and that's what was happening. But it was happening from my legs, from my knees, all the way down to my toes, almost constantly. So initially, like you would think, went to a dermatologist and did that for about 6 months with really no improvement. And I'm sure with the frustration that the dermatologist was facing, started to question if it was sort of my own anxieties, and it was sort of a picking habit that I was occurring, and really had to advocate that this was something that I wasn't doing. It truly, I couldn't handle it. It just kept happening. Then, coincidentally, sort of at the same time, one day in class, I felt this little pain right above my collarbone and felt this small little lump and thought, maybe I slept weird last night, had my mom look at it, didn't think too much of it. And then about 2 weeks later, those little bumps were really everywhere, all over both sides of my collarbone, up my neck, and then went to the pediatrician. From there, got a few more tests done. Those still came back normal. But luckily, he really pushed and said, something's not right here. And I ended up at Golisano right there at the hospital. Didn't even really know I was going to the oncology unit. And my oncologist, Dr. Andelina, he felt my neck, looked at my legs. And just from those two things, knowing this world, he said, I think you have cancer. I was like, this guy needs to slow his roll. He hasn't done any tests yet. He's just looked at me. There's no way. But I did get a CT scan later that day, and it was cancer. And so that itching is a really weird and kind of unique side effect of the Hodgkin's lymphoma I had. And so right from there, diagnosed, and then went through four rounds of chemo, radiation. And luckily, I'm here on the other side.
Side note entirely. Everyone in the system means well. Having met people very close to me who've gone through that diagnosis, not a fan of telling someone, I think you have cancer, but I don't know for sure. I'm not a fan of that. I would prefer that we make sure.
Absolutely.
But everybody's doing their best, I understand. And, you know, you're a sophomore. What are you, 15, 16 years old when this is happening?
Yes, I was 15 years old. I spent my sweet 16 filled with chemo and a bunch of pain meds, not having a great time. And it was just, like, incredibly difficult. You know, everyone in your lives, especially in high school, your whole life is at school and everything that you do there. And I was just immediately pulled out of it. I mean, occasionally I could try and go to class, but even being there, it felt so alien just because my entire world and thoughts were doctor's appointments, medications, mm-hmm. blood draws, and their whole worlds were school, classes, gym, that kind of thing. So it's definitely difficult.
Kids should not be just focused on how do I survive.
Absolutely.
And so I understand that that's what your mind was probably on a lot. You talk about going to chemo like it was like an after school. Like, oh, it was chemo and then it was radiation.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the farther away it gets, hopefully the less visceral it gets the memory of it.
Definitely.
And I say that having talked to plenty of people who've gone through cancer treatment, including our producer, Megan Mack. I mean, the longer you go, hopefully, though, it feels a little bit more like a distant memory or almost like, did I really do that? But how visceral is it still? Do you still think about it or has that kind of receded?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way and the things I think about have changed. So initially, after treatment, way back 13 years ago, it was that, you know, constantly feeling where my tumors had been and the fear of that initial cancer coming back. Then, you know, in these later years, it's not as relevant. I mean, I think with my job now working in it, I do think about it probably a little bit more than I would without this job. But I think it's more so just keeping an eye on where I am now. Mm-hmm. And it does get easier. I think it's just a different way. I've learned to be more comfortable in these settings that used to carry a lot more trauma and heavy feelings. Just because it is going to be a part of my life for the rest of it. But I still do get those anxieties with every scan. I don't think that's going to go away, and I don't think there's an answer for that to go away except for, you know, that result that tells you things are good.
When you're 15 and 16 years old dealing with this, if someone asks you what you need, I'm not even sure how you get your head around that. But now, you know, as an adult, you've got more than a decade of time, and you think about what kids and young adults are going through now. What do you think they need? What do you think you most needed besides obviously the treatment? You need your health, you need your future. But beyond that, what did you need that maybe you couldn't articulate at the time, but you think kids and young adults need?
I think they need to have their lives be as normal as it can be. I think the biggest thing and what we always hear is, I just want to be normal again. I just want to be who I was before. And while that isn't obtainable, having your friends around you to have them catch up with the school drama or what's going on in their lives, to hear about your crazy aunt and her weird antics, all of those things, if you can keep those going, it allows those heavier and non-normal parts of your day to seem less impactful and allows you to not be sort of in an alien world. You're still in your world. There's just some other added characters.
In some ways, that's staying in touch with whatever extracurriculars. For some kids, that might be sports or arts in different ways. It's also just the social structure, because so much of your life that time is friend groups, et cetera. I hope people stayed tight with you. Were people pretty good with what you were going through?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a really great support within the schools, and it was kind of nice, too, because nice in a weird way. It was my sophomore year, so I was able to sort of rekindle those relationships and kind of get back to a normal setting through the later years in high school, but definitely had a lot of people come up. I mean, the initial few weeks when I hadn't really told people was a little shaky. There was a lot of your classic high school, like, whispering in the hallway as you pass, like, what's going on? So that wasn't the great impact initially, and was sort of difficult and a little fearful to kind of tell people what was going on at that point. But overall, people were really helpful and just open to do what they could.
Well, I mean, I'm so glad to see you doing well now. You're doing great work in the community. We're going to talk about some events that are coming up here that are tied to all of this work here. And Caitlin, in general, when you hear Michaela's story, I know you know this story. How much do you think about what 1330 needs to do now and be aware of for kids and young adults?
Well, first, the fact that we have Michaela to continually, that's such a huge part of our work, is making sure that we hear from our members about what they need. That's a really important piece to our work, making sure that that's actually what we provide. And one thing that we hear a lot, and Michaela has talked about this as well, is meeting other teens and young adults who have had cancer. And so that is just existing is addressing that need that comes up, that depending on what setting, you know, whether they're treated in the pediatric setting and they are the oldest kids there, or they're treated on the adult side of medicine and they're the youngest by far in the waiting room. Almost everyone that comes to us says, we've never met another teen or young adult with cancer. And so we exist to create that space and foster the support for each other, to the chance to meet another teen or young adult.
I find this part of these conversations about cancer, and we do a lot on cancer on this program, but this is what's unique about this. We talk a lot about breast cancer. You get a breast cancer diagnosis, and there's nothing good about that. But what is helpful is you will find a lot of people who have breast cancer, people you didn't know might have been diagnosed, and you'll be much more aware of it. I mean, it happens. There's a lot of different cancers. For kids and young adults, it's like you're on an island.
Correct.
This wasn't supposed to happen, especially now.
Correct.
So if people need to get in touch with you, how do they find you, Caitlin?
Our website, 1330.org. We're very active on social media as well. Our handle, 1330. And on our website directs you can reach out, connect through us directly there. And again, through social media on Instagram, Facebook as well.
In a moment, we're also going to turn our attention to some of the work that people like Charlie do, which is help people understand how they can maybe take care of themselves when they need it. And I know we've talked about your family story a bit here, but will you remind listeners a little bit about how you ended up connected with this organization?
Yeah. My son was diagnosed with cancer when he was 16 years old. He had a mole on his head, and his life was transformed immediately by that experience, as you can imagine. And what I really appreciate about Michaela's story as it relates to my son Charlie's story is that both of you wanted to stay actively engaged in your life. You did not want to see yourself as somebody who was degraded or incapable of functioning. He was a musician and a songwriter, and he kept doing that. He was a creator. And one of the things that inspires me about his life and what I find meaning in, I don't find meaning in his cancer and his illness and his dying. He died in 2005, sadly. I find inspiration in him being a creator. And the work that I'm doing now with Path Forward Counseling and Path Forward Creative Wellness, which is the group practice that I started about a year ago, is to bring expressive and meditative arts into the community. And one of the ways that I do that now is at 1330 Cancer Connect, which is one of the great joys of my life. I get to go there and do poetry workshops. I'm doing one next week. We're going to talk about meeting your cancer shadow and developing a relationship with those parts of yourself that maybe frighten you, and then finding empowerment in that, finding an inner strength. I have the privilege of teaching them other practices. I practice Zen tangling, which is an art practice, which is a meditative practice. And I got to introduce a lot of the young adults at Camp Good Days.
Yes.
And that was amazing because three or four people started there. They were nervous. Most people, when you say, hey, you want to do some art, it brings up anxiety. And so,
correct. Yes. For me too. Yes.
Well, I'm about teaching the art of how to not be artistic, how to be expressive, how to get in touch with those parts of yourself that, you know,
I find that actually profound. Can you say that again? You don't have to be artistic, but be expressive.
That's right.
Because there's pressure, I think, when people think, well, I'm sitting down to create something, but I'm not an artist.
We had a young woman come to.
But anybody can be expressive.
Yeah. Anyway, we had a young woman come to one of our expressive art experiences. We called it Making Space. And she grew up with a lot of expectation and pressure to be a good artist. And I think that's the wrong word to put on it. You don't need to be a good artist. Every one of us is creative. Every one of us has a way of expressing ourselves. Look at children. They are uninhibited. They express themselves artistically. They are not evaluating whether it's good art or bad art. They're just simply being. And they're able to, using their imagination, using play, able to experience greater behavior potential just by the power of self-expression. And that's what I try to teach people. I try to demystify art. Zen tangling's nice because what you do is you create a little grid and you take fragments and you repeat those fragments in that grid. And it doesn't have to, you know, be perfect. You don't have to hang it on a wall. I want to read something that Kurt Vonnegut said, one of my favorite writers. He wrote this famously back years ago to Xavier High School. He wrote a letter to them. He said, practice any art, music, singing, dancing, acting, drawing, painting, sculpting, poetry, fiction, essays, reportage, no matter how well or badly, not to get money and fame, but to experience becoming, to find out what's inside you, to make your soul grow. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to do that with teens and young adults. Some research that's come out about that is pretty profound in that regard. There was a review of literature in 2010 that argued that engaging in creative activities can mitigate the impact of chronic diseases by reducing stress and depression. So I think it's essential that we all get in touch with these aspects of ourselves to be creative. We live in a consumer society, you know, and the more consumption we do, I think the smaller we get. The more creative we get, the bigger we get. And that was the story of my son Charlie's life. Even though he died, he lived his life not as if he were dying, but he was creating music to the end.
The research you're pointing to is really interesting because I think, I'm just guessing here, Charlie, and you're the expert here, but my guess is when you work with people, you do have to get some people over this idea of stop asking yourself if it's good, stop being paralyzed by whether it's good, and just find outlets to express.
Right.
But I imagine a lot of people say to you, but I'm not any good.
You are more than you know, and give yourself permission to experience that. My son left in his journal this quote that inspires me. He said, certainty is the cage that keeps us safe from curiosity. I've been released from the cage. I am the songbird, and I'm flying for the window. I know it's closed, but I plan on breaking through. He wasn't concerned about perfection. He was concerned about exploration, discovery, making art. Whether it was good or not, that inspired me. That inspires me. I mean, the more you make art, the better you get at it. But when you start, there's that anxiety. I think a creative spirit pushes through difficulty because there's so much opportunity on the other side of it. So sometimes what we have to do is encourage and coach and say, just give it a try. Let's see how it goes.
Damn, Charlie, you're going to break me, man.
How so?
Well, just because anybody listening right now can think of how unfair what you have gone through is and how truly unjust cancer can be. And I've got a 12-year-old son, and he is one of the most privileged human beings who's ever lived.
That's because you're his dad.
But there aren't guarantees. No one thinks that they're going to outlive their children.
Right.
And I am just so moved every time I talk to you because of what you have given to the community in this loss. You've created this, you know, this flower that grows from the soil that you never wanted to exist in the first place. And I just, I'm sorry, but I'm grateful, if that makes sense, Charlie.
I appreciate that. I'm grateful too. I'm not grateful that I lost him. I'm grateful that I had him for 18 years. I mean, I can look at it like I've been robbed, and I've felt that way a lot. But mostly what I try to do is find inspiration and meaning in the life that he was given and to have gratitude for that. Mm. But that was not how I felt right after or during, you know, so that's been a process. I'm really excited about doing this work with the teens and young adults. You know, we provide an emotional outlet and coping when we do this kind of work. We help them promote self-expression and identity, which is really essential for young people. We provide peer support and social connection. One of the most profound things that we do when we do these creative, expressive things is when people start to share the work that they do. Something profound opens up, and it's really great to be part of it. We can enhance quality of life with these practices, and we can provide empowerment and hope. So that's what I want to bring into the world more. That's what my son wanted to bring in the world. That's what Michaela wants to bring in the world. Caitlin wants to bring in the world. You know, so that's what we're trying to do.
How do people get in touch with you if they want to do this kind of stuff?
Well, we have a website, pathforwardcounseling.com, but it's path-forward-counseling.com. That's a way you can get in touch with us.
We're talking about a young adult cancer, adolescent cancer, rates of childhood cancer. And I do want to ask Dr. Jamie Fleur-Laghi, who's with us, about what you think the audience needs to understand. You know, so much of what our guests have been talking about is the mental health aspect of all of this and how kids and young adults go through this and what they need. But often families need to know the kinds of treatment and options that are out there. And sometimes that starts with something like a clinical trial. So I want to just give you some space to talk about what you're seeing and what you want people to understand.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. I mean, I think what you've heard is there's no better privilege to not just cure my patients, but watch them survive and thrive. The best thing is when part of their journey is their cancer, that is just a part of them. It's not all of them. It's not who they are. It's just a part of their big picture in life. And the way that we can help foster that are through these connections. So I'm proud that through treatment, I'm grateful in Rochester, we have many things like 1330 Cancer Connect and like Path Forward and other things to help our patients both be treated adequately for what we need to give them and treat their whole person that whole time and their family. And every patient needs something different. In terms of treatment, thank you for asking. I think it's really important that we learn from every patient to create a better tomorrow. And one of the ways we do that is through clinical trials and from learning from every patient. So specifically for our adolescents and young adults, and when we say that, that's this 15 to 39-year-old age range, they are historically under-enrolled on trials. And what that means is that they are not accessing a chance for a better cure at the same rate as other groups. So there's a lot of misinformation, and it's a challenge to understand that really when we talk about clinical trials, for most people, we're talking about the experts in the world have come together to make a change, to either give less medicine and achieve the same cure, to give different medicine that has better short-term and long-term side effects and achieve the same outcome. So a chance at curing, quote, better. So what that looks like for adolescents and young adults, why is it so hard then for this group? It's because it's a hard time in life. It's hard to be 15. It's hard to be 25. There's so many barriers to access to trials. Depends on what door you walked in. Did a pediatric provider, usually 18 and under, see you first? Did an adult provider see you first? What tools do they have in their toolbox, et cetera? So one important thing is, and I'm proud to say in our region, at Wilmot Cancer, when you walk in the door, it doesn't matter what door you walked in. We have access to everything. And so for our adolescents and young adults, what that means, if you came in an adult door, we will show you everything available to you. If you walk in our pediatric door, the same. Our patients are not here for our trials. Our trials are here for our patients. So we need to overcome all barriers so every patient, whether you have parents at your side or you don't, whether you have a family, whether you're in college, it doesn't matter. What do they need? What do they understand? What options do they have? And making sure they really heard them. It's a very challenging time to figure out what you want to wear to school, let alone what treatment you want and what those options are. So often trials are not always the forefront of that because of the barriers. So to me, one very exciting thing is that I can offer patients, so I treat primarily Hodgkin lymphoma. And why I love it is because we can cure patients and we can every day try to cure them better than we did the day before. And so how do we do that? Through minimizing therapy, really with a focus on how are we going to keep their hearts healthy now and in 30 years? How are we going to make sure that they can have their own children someday and keep their fertility if they want them? How do we do all those things now, not just cure them? And like you heard, not just cure them and get rid of their cancer. Thankfully for that disease, we can. How do we cure them and help them thrive and be resilient humans who go on to just have well-intended, productive lives, unlocking their creativity and whatever that looks like? Because this has only been a part of their story, but it doesn't define them.
When you talk about misinformation about trials,
yeah,
I'll tell you what came to mind for me when people I love, a couple of them, were going through similar questions. And the ideas or the stereotypes I had versus what your community of experts had to explain. It sounded like this. They said, you know, you may think of a trial as some sort of risky new thing that, you know, isn't really tested and we just need subjects. And, you know, do you want to try that? As opposed to, hey, there's a future where cancer treatment isn't so tough, doesn't do damage to the body in parts to take care of other problems in the body. And we're not there right now. And we don't love chemo. A future without chemo is what we all want. But we will eventually, slowly, through these trials, find a little less invasive, a little less intense, a little less duration, and be a little bit more targeted. And we believe that these trials are going to get us there. Now, the trials are trials for a reason, but we are very confident in them that if you can get in them, do it. Because there's a chance that you're getting the kind of treatment that people will have as the next step of next phase. And the second I heard that, I was like, oh my gosh, all the trials. Trials for everybody. So I just changed how I viewed the whole thing.
And it's different for every patient. But the nice part is, like you said, there's a summary. Every trial is asking one or two main questions to push an envelope and to try and do something better. And a lot of the things you see on the news all the time, this latest drug, the latest everything, you know, those only become standard through trials and learning. And they're important. Are they better? And how are they better if we're going to keep using them? And so really, it's every patient allowing us to try to change the future and hopefully change treatment for them as well. They're all monitored and closed. If we're learning they're not safe, they're closed early. As soon as they're done, if we realize it's not better than the standard of care and we've learned something new, they're shut down, even during therapy. But it is so important that we at least give people access, a choice. Really help them understand what that looks like, what is the question asking, and it might not be right for them. But the point is, everybody needs all their options and to know and understand wherever they're at in life and help overcome whatever their barriers are to receiving the best treatment for them.
Can I just ask you one other question about where we're going in the future with treatment?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to denigrate chemo. There are generations past that would have done anything for the kind of treatments we have now.
That's right.
That gives people a chance to get through, as unpleasant as chemo can be. But, I mean, there has to be a future where we're not doing chemo anymore. I don't know if it's a generation. I don't know if it's five. I don't know if it's in our lifetimes. Maybe do you see that in the future?
What we're seeing is certainly for certain diseases, there's either a lock and key mechanism where we can give them a drug and we've really figured it out with intensive research what the key is and we can turn it off and make it a chronic disease. So that's one path that thankfully has happened for a whole bunch of diagnoses. Second path, we've learned how to turn on their own immune system to clear the cells, which is amazing. Now, those also aren't without side effects. So even when doing that, we still have to do that on a trial. Mm-hmm. So we know what are the pros, but also what are the cons. So we're not making a trade-off for something that's going to be a problem 30 years later because your immune system is there for a really good reason. And then for some diagnoses, it's just harder. The cells are really resistant. And as soon as you actually turn them off with a key, they close that door and they open a different one. And so for some things, we still need chemotherapy as a whole. And likely what the future will be is a combination of a little chemotherapy to do a lot of heavy lifting and a little bit of immunotherapy to sort of clean up the rest and make sure it doesn't come back. And I think we'll see that in our lifetime.
What about nanotech? What about really cool stuff that feels super futury? That's above my pay grade.
So really cool futury things, I will put that in sort of science and lay terms all at once, okay. Which is what we're learning is, for instance, your example of saying you have breast cancer. That doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah.
There are so many different kinds. And so what's happening is that we're getting this massive list of all the different kinds of cancer. And so where it will go is you'll get a very specific diagnosis. And the cookbook or treatment for each one will look very different. And that's precision medicine. And that is certainly getting there.
I have to take our only break of the hour. And when we come back, I want to tell you about some events that are coming up here. There's a lot happening in this community to support people who need it the most that we've been talking about this hour. And I'm going to give our guests some time to go through all of that. I'm so grateful they're here. And my guess is for listeners who don't know them, that's probably because, you know, you haven't had that need. But if you do, thank God they're here. So let's take that break. We'll come right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson, host of Connections. We bring you in-depth conversations with newsmakers, with people from all backgrounds and points of view in our community. And it's a chance for you in the audience to join the conversation in various ways. 2 hours every weekday. We're proud to bring you these conversations, and we look forward to joining you next time on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I imagine Lauren Spiker's ears were ringing because we were talking about you, Lauren, who is with us now, the founder of 1330 Cancer Connect. Welcome back to the program, Lauren. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me. I'm at the Capitol right now, so thanks for getting me on for a minute or two.
And I know that part of your work there is receiving that New York State resolution declaring April Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Awareness Month, yes?
Yeah, that's right. The event is at 3 o'clock, and it'll be a resolution signed by the governor declaring AYA as or April as AYA month. So, we're pretty proud to be here today.
Lauren, you and I have had these conversations in the past, and mm-hmm. I want you to know your colleagues are doing a phenomenal job on this program today. I know you're very busy, so I'll just ask you in general how you have perceived the work in the nearly quarter century since you lost your daughter to cancer when she was just, 19 years old. How have you seen this work? Has it changed? And how do you feel today?
Yes, and I have no doubt that the rest of the team is doing a great job. So tell them hello to everybody. So, yeah, it's been almost 25 years, which is hard to imagine. And in those 25 years, there has been some significant changes, thank goodness. The landscape of care for our adolescents and young adults is changing. We're now seeing much greater awareness of their unique challenges, and we're beginning to see some actions which are trying to meet some of their unmet needs. So while there's been a great work done, there is still so much more to be done. So we're still out there trying to do exactly that. And I hope this is what Melissa had in mind.
Well, I mean, the legacy and the work that you've done, I mean, I have just so much affection for what you've done for this community coming out of this kind of a loss. What do you think this community, especially the community of, you know, the community that you never want to be in as a parent or as a family, but for the families who are in that community, what do they need the most right now, Lauren?
Yeah, thanks, Evan. You know, I think what our families need the most is room to talk about their kids, to not let their children ever be forgotten. I know that was important to Melissa, and it's important to me that we keep speaking her name. And for our families who unfortunately have had the same loss that our family has had, it's progress to see that things will get better for kids that do survive. So I think for all of us whose children are not here, to see progress, to see that, you know, their children, while they didn't benefit from some of the new advances, that the other families will not have to suffer the same loss. So I think continued progress and constant mention of their name and how important their lives were while they were here.
Lauren, you are a force. I'm always filled up by talking to you. I know how hard you have worked over these years. Thank you for that, and thanks for joining the conversation today.
Oh, well, thanks for having us. And I hope next time to see you in person, Evan.
You got it. That's Lauren Spiker, who is the founder and executive director of 1330 Cancer Connect. And in Albany, popping in here on the program on a very, very busy day. Before we tell you about some events that are coming up in our community, and there's a number to tell you about, you know, I was watching Charlie and your reaction in the question on trials. I know that certain things were popping to your mind. What do you want people to understand?
Well, back when my son was going through his cancer treatment, we went to the National Cancer Institute, and he was enrolled in a cell replacement therapy trial, which is really cutting edge at the time. And he had good results early on, but then it reversed itself, and he sadly passed. But I will say, Lauren, to her credit, she was in that treatment room when that cell replacement therapy was beginning. She and her husband, Doug, were down in the area, and they came and visited us, and it just brightened my son. But when I want to fast forward with the story, I have a neighbor who lived in the neighborhood where Charlie grew up, who was diagnosed at my age with melanoma, same cancer that my son had, and he is benefiting from the medications that probably my son was trialing back in the day, and he's doing great. The neighbor's doing great. So wow. I'm really thrilled about that. I'm thrilled to think that my son, through, you know, well, desire to be better and to be healed, but also to give back, to be willing to make life better for others. And so I just want to thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you.
What a story. If just joining us, we're talking to an entire panel of folks, the team from 1330 Cancer Connect, and you just heard Dr. Jamie Flerlaghi, who is a professor in the Cancer Center and the Departments of Pediatrics, Hematology, and Oncology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Charlie Cote, Michaela Deeg, Caitlin McDougall here from 1330 Cancer Connect. Michaela, a long list of events coming up here in April. You want to take us through some things that are happening?
Definitely, yeah. So as you know, April is AYA Cancer Awareness Month, and so we pack it full. So coming up this Friday is one of my favorite events and a really exciting and accessible one. We do a stand-up performance at Comedy at the Carlson where our members, so teens, young adults who have faced cancer, are the ones up there making you laugh at cancer. And a lot of times people think comedy, cancer, I can't laugh at someone like that.
I don't know, are we allowed to do this?
But we want you to laugh, and we want you to feel a little uncomfortable. I mean, we have all gone through a very uncomfortable, not so great time. And so it's a really great medium for people to start to understand what our teens, young adults go through, how they can approach them, and also just give our members a chance, like Charlie's talked about, get that creative expression, have that boost of confidence within themselves. So that's super exciting. That's going to be right at the Carlson. Tickets on sale, less than 100 left. So make sure to jump on those.
That's Friday.
Yep, that's this coming Friday. And then, of course, we do those fundraising, those fun events, but we also like to do stuff on the medical side. So next Friday, we're going to be doing a sexual health workshop. It's focused on adolescent and young adults with cancer in that world of the sexual health conferencing. And it's going to be offering continuing education credits. So if there are oncologists, nurse practitioners, social workers out there who are needing those credits or just haven't really dove into this world before and could bulk up their knowledge within this world, this is going to be a really great thing. It's completely free. So that's next Friday, the 26th. And then we're rounding it all out on that Saturday. We're going to be doing a yoga class with Alex Aletto. She's a really great yoga instructor out here. So there's going to be yoga class, sound bath, jewelry making. There's going to be some massaging happening. And so that's a ticketed event, and that's going to be next Saturday. And that's sort of how we'll round out the month. We've done a lot of fun things and a lot of fun things moving forward. And then outside of that as well, for people, if there are teens, young adults who have cancer, that are looking for our programming. We do that monthly, typically 2 to 3 times a month. And we actually have one coming up next week with Charlie, who's going to be hosting us. So a little bit of everything kind of coming down the pipe.
Let's work backwards. I want to talk to Charlie. But if you want the full schedule, is it online? Can people check it out? Where is it?
So right on our website, 1330.org, as well as we typically post daily and right before all events right on Instagram as well.
Okay. So Charlie, tell us about this event that's coming up here.
We're going to be writing about our experience with cancer, trying to get in touch with those aspects of it that maybe frighten us, trying to make a relationship with cancer in whatever way that emerges. What I love about creative writing is I get to discover things that I always knew but didn't know I knew it until I started to do the creative process. So I'm sure things are going to emerge. And then, you know, they're going to get in touch with us using kind of a mindfulness meditative process. Then we're going to do some writing. Then we're going to do a self-portrait where everybody's going to draw a picture of themselves without looking at the paper. They're going to just look at themselves. It's going to be on Zoom, so they'll be able to see themselves and they'll just draw a picture. And then I have a series of questions where they'll ask something of that, like, you know, what do you want from me now or something like that? Just some way to get the creative juices flowing. And what I found doing this exercise with other adults that I've worked with is that it's a very profound encounter with oneself. And the group sharing part of it takes it to a whole nother level. So I'm really looking forward to it.
What's the date on this one?
That is going to be the next Thursday. So that's for really anyone 13 to 39 years of age who has been diagnosed with cancer. Let us know really if you contact other through our Instagram, through our page, we can get you that Zoom link to go with that. But yeah, just really for our members, this is like our typical programming that we do. Charlie's just going to be hosting this. And so just kind of a fun way to get everyone going.
Thursday, April 25th. And Charlie is the man to make you feel comfortable drawing a picture of yourself without even looking at the page. Because everybody's hearing that going like, wow, that would be an experience. But Charlie is going to make you feel differently about it.
You're going to dig it. You're going to dig it. You're going to see yourself in a whole new way.
This, Charlie is the guy, for sure. We mentioned it, Comedy at the Carlson is Friday. What time does it start?
That is going to be, so we're going to have doors open at 6:30. So we're going to have some raffle baskets, wine pulls, all that fun stuff. The show itself, performance-wise, I believe is 7, 8?
It's in there.
Right in there.
So right. That's on Friday. The day for the sexual health and wellness event is when?
That is going to be the 26th.
Two Fridays from now. Yep. Is that primarily for practitioners? Yes?
That's Caitlin right? Can speak.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And this falls under, all of our programs either fall under peer support, so that's directly for teens and young adults, like the writing workshop that Charlie and Michaela just talked about. Those fall under our peer support programs. This educational workshop falls under our branch of advocacy, where we try to make sure that providers know about some of the unmet needs that our AYAs face. And so that's what inspired this sexual health workshop. So it's for oncologists, nurse practitioners, PAs, social workers, nurses, anyone who provides care to our AYA patients.
Well, let me ask the practitioner in the room. Doctor, you know, one of the observations that I had, just kind of... there's been a lot of cancer in my sphere in the last decade or so. And sometimes there's an assumption that, well, this kind of cancer is people typically are of this kind of age, et cetera. But then it's like, well, do we talk about things like fertility? Do we talk about things like sex? And it can be really uncomfortable, so maybe we don't. Or is it on the patient to ask? So how do you view the role of the practitioner with all of that?
It is our job and our role, and it is sorely undertaught in medical education,
why?
Which is why, because, you know, there's a lot of focus. First of all, the world is changing, and medical education needs to change with that. We didn't talk about fertility ages ago, sometimes for really good reasons, because people weren't surviving. But now they are. And we also have things like in vitro fertilization that also didn't exist before. So both patients are surviving, and there's new options. And we need to do a better job teaching it. But sexual health is always a touchy one. If you are not comfortable with talking about sexual health practices yourself, it will never be comfortable talking about them with a patient. And if it is not comfortable for me as a provider to bring it up, how do I ever expect it to be more comfortable for my teenage patient to bring it up? It is our job. It is our duty. It's an unmet need. So things like this are needed because, yes, the more you talk about it, it's not just something you can just read about. You have to practice bringing this up. How do you bring it up? Not everybody wants the same. Everybody comes to the room with a different set of knowledge. So it's very important. It's a sort of different skill set. What do you know about this topic? Not just what do you know? Tell me about that. Is it accurate? Let me talk to you. And all you, all on your own, not with whoever you brought with you. This is a one-on-one with your patient. Then when you figure out if there are others who can be part of that dynamic, you can bring them in. But really, it's a focused, specific skill set. It is the practitioner's job, and we need to do better at it.
Are your patients surprised when you bring it up?
I think mine are not because it's part of every one of my routine conversations. But depending on who it is, I often get consulted, can we do these things? What are those? People know who to go to for your, who likes to talk to their teens and adolescents? It's me. So I often get the consult. I love them. There's nothing I love more than my teenagers. And they know that fact. So I'm often brought in, hey, can you talk about this? Gladly. And this is where it needs to be common knowledge, common language and practice. If I'm going to ask them, did they get their blood counts? I'm going to ask them, did they go sperm bank? And we're going to talk about it.
I love what you're saying about that, because if you're a provider that doesn't collaborate with your patients and doesn't give them autonomy and doesn't raise their skill level or provide the kind of relatedness that they need, then maybe you should think about another field. I love what you're saying. It's so good.
It's become easier for me, but this is because it's my passion and I love my job. And so it helps me remember I'm in the right space.
Do parents object?
So it's a conversation first with that child, and there are very good rules in place that allow it to be. Fertility and sexual health is all about that patient, and they don't need consent and they don't need anything else. Now, we do try to engage parents because often it can be the reverse. You know, as a teen, again, it's hard enough to choose what to wear in the morning, let alone, do I want a sperm bank for children I don't know that I ever want someday?
Right.
Now, sometimes you need the group think to say, you know what, just like I made you brush your teeth at night, we're going to do this. There's no harm to you. This is important, and I worry you're going to regret it later. So sometimes it does need to be a group decision at the end of the day, or I should say group discussion. But thankfully, there are nice laws in place as well that it is just with that patient first.
Do you sense that your colleagues are as comfortable as you are in talking about this?
So,
and I'm not asking you to denigrate colleagues.
No,
I'm just talking about more industry.
Yeah, importantly, the short answer is no.
Yeah.
However, yeah. I treat a disease that is primarily of adolescents and young adults, and most of my providers in my group, it's 10 and younger. And so unfortunately, these are not conversations they have the privilege of having.
Yeah.
I do. And so for our adolescent and young adult providers, this is a growing skill set and we all need it, not just about fertility, about their health, how their sexual functioning is affected by their treatment. All these things matter, both at the beginning of therapy and after.
I mean, I think your colleagues who are amazing, but also oncologists at every level could maybe bring these conversations up more on their own.
They could, and we're working to build up other resources as well here on campus at Golisano Children's Hospital and at Wilmot Cancer Center, because some of it also are barriers. What are the costs to doing those, right? Not everybody is privileged to pay for some of these things. So it is something we are all working. It's an all hands on deck thing.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground this hour. And before it's up, let me just ask Caitlin McDougall if you want to tell the audience a little bit more about what 1330 is doing and frankly how much you've grown. I mean, we talked to your founder earlier this hour, and it's not an organization that Lauren Spiker ever thought she would create, and she lost her daughter and she created this organization that is doing remarkable things. How many people you're serving and the best way for people to get in touch with you when they need you?
Sure. You're absolutely right. When Lauren started this over 20 years ago, she started offering the support programs in her living room. And this was back in the 2000s where there wasn't a recognition that this was even a unique population. So that's grown now. Lauren opened the doors at an official center in Rochester in 2020. We expanded to have a second site in Syracuse. And so we're able to support and reach really across central New York as well in providing these kind of support programs. And the best way to get a hold of us, again, 1330.org. We also are on Facebook and Instagram, another great way to see all of our upcoming events.
Are you seeing growth and outreach simply because people know about you? Are you seeing growth because of diagnosis? What are you seeing?
I would say both.
Yeah.
We know, and Lauren is actually working on a study partnering with other University of Rochester colleagues to try and understand the exact picture of AYA cancer here in Rochester and Monroe County, to better have a picture of exactly who are these AYAs that we're serving. So we do know that this population is growing. There's the incidence we're expected to increase, as well as our outreach efforts, and then making sure our colleagues, community members know about us and know how to get the support.
Last question, Michaela, you told the story of how you're doing. When you meet people who you might see a little bit of yourself in some of the people, some of these teenagers who get diagnosed, do you think it helps them to be able to hear from someone who has been there and you know, you've got this life and you've turned this corner, essentially?
Absolutely. I think, for anyone, I remember even myself seeing someone thriving, which is sort of what we talked about, that thriving status, seeing that is so powerful, especially when your thoughts are so consumed with anxiety of the future, uncertainty of where you're landing now after this. So it's been incredibly rewarding to sort of be that person for our members out in Syracuse when I run those programs, and often kind of get the question of, you know, how do we get to this point? And it's a tough one to hear, but it's just putting in the time, and we're here for you when you need us.
Continued good health to you. Thank you for telling your story here. Our thanks as well to Caitlin McDougall, a program director for 1330 Cancer Connect. Thank you for being with us here. Our thanks to Charlie Cote, who is now with Path-Forward. Go ahead.
Path-Forward-Counseling.com.
Path-Forward-Counseling.com. Charlie is a unique individual, lost his son, but his son is still in so many ways. That artistic spirit is with us through you. Thank you for being here, Charlie.
My pleasure.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
And our thanks to Dr. Jamie Flerlaghi. Thank you for your expertise this hour.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
From the whole team at Connections, Evan, Rob, Megan, Mari, saying thank you for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.